This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. So our next guest today is a linguist, actually a sociolinguist, which is a fancy way of saying, you know, someone who studies the way we use language. Valerie Friedland is a professor at the University of Nevada, Reno, and she's sharing her learnings in a new book, Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. In it, she seeks to reframe words, phrases, and sounds that many of us have been taught and deeply believe are just bad English. She says these ways of speaking are really like the leading edge of where language is going. Look, some of the ideas here could literally blow your mind, and I am excited that she is gifting us her time today. Valerie Friedland, dude, if I may, welcome to the 21st show.
Sure, dude. Thank you.
All right. I counted at least 11 words or vocal tics in that introduction, which normally I would have worked very hard to avoid using on the radio. If any of that set your teeth on edge, we want to hear from you today at 800-222-9455. What do you hear people saying nowadays that strikes you as just plain wrong? And what do you think of Valerie Friedland's search for the good in bad English? 800-222-9455 is the number to join us. That's 800-222-9455. One of the central ideas of your book is that language is dynamic, right? Always evolving. I need to be convinced of that. So wilt thou explain thyself?
Absolutely. And I think you exemplify it beautifully right there. If you go back in time in the history of English itself, which is not that old of a language when you compare it to the historical record of all the other languages that are around, you see that English has changed substantially since the days of Old English. And any of us who had to slog through Beowulf in high school can attest to this. But even Shakespeare, which came many centuries later, say Shakespeare is an early modern writer, that was really hard for us to read. My kids just finished Romeo and Juliet, and I heard a lot of whining about how they couldn't understand what was going on. And what's interesting is language has changed so much in its history, in the short history of English, about 1,000, 1,500 years. It's changed so drastically. We've lost almost every inflectional ending in our language. We used to have case marking on every word. We used to have gender marking, grammatical gender. We used to have plural marking. We had a strong and a weak verb class. But all of that has gone by the wayside. So the changes that we see today, the changes in the last two centuries, are so much less than the changes that have affected English over its history, that it's sort of surprising that the complaint tradition, where we don't like those changes, has actually grown a lot more vocal in the last two centuries than it ever was in the prior thousand before that. So it's really that we notice it more and that we are more upset about it because we have these really strong beliefs about what good English is and what bad English is.
All right. Well, what is the origin of the language police then? You said two centuries now.
It's about the 18th century. And that happened when there were some massive sociocultural shifts happening in Britain. Prior to that point, we really, first of all, didn't have this idea of individual action and free will. We also had extreme class division. So you were in a rigid hierarchy in terms of what you were expected to do, what you were allowed to do, and the types of language that you were allowed to use with different people. So, for example, our pronouns were very distributed by rank and status. But around the 1600s and 1700s, a couple things happened. First of all, English rose to be a language of literature, which it had never been before. In fact, we didn't really have a printing press that printed a lot of books before. So literacy wasn't something that anybody had, unless you were, for example, a priest or a monk or a leader of some sort. But also, we had a rigid class breakdown. So you didn't necessarily have these really insurmountable boundaries between different classes. So the upper class was now made up of not just those that were born of aristocracy, but also those who had become wealthy with this new cultural center of London and the trade and the merchant class. So this became an issue where the only thing that sort of helped you stand apart if you were aristocracy was language. And so it became really important in the 1700s to establish the dominance of the aristocratic class because language was the only thing that was left to keep them apart from the nouveau riche. And so this is where we see this huge drive for codification and standardization of English. mainly on upper class norms by upper class speakers who realize, well, we can make a buck at the same time that we establish ourselves as the linguistic leaders. And that is really what inspired this rise of the language police.
Yeah, this is classifieds at the heart of it. You have an anecdote in the book about your friend who's, I think, a doctor who is dating a manager of a party store, and it doesn't work out because of language, or at least in part, maybe, because of language.
Right, because of that being so so overt of a class divide. So we still today use language as a way to separate out people that are like us and those that are less like us. And we have a tendency towards something called homophily, which is just a fancy way of saying birds of a feather flock together. And also birds of a feather like each other more. So this is true both of the way that we engage socially, but also linguistically.
So there are some changes in our language over time that are in our face, right? I mean, the rise of Karen is an insult, or people using like every fifth word. But you say a lot of this change happens without our noticing it. So, like, in a little while on the show, I'm going to say, like, in a little while on the show, I'm going to say, we've got to take a break. I'm not going to say we must take a break. What is going on there?
Yes. Well, a lot of those things arise when we are not paying attention to them. And what happens is it's not because not until it reaches sort of this massive level of change that we start to say, oh my goodness, I'm doing this. And oh, my teenagers are doing this. And now I'm horrified. But it creeps in slowly because most language change is unconscious. And it is driven by the unconscious needs and voids that we experience in our daily interactions. And those little things like saying going or must, changing to have to or gotta, are driven by these changes in either societal norms or changes in efficiency, various different pushes. And so, for example, the switch from the word must, which is something called deontic modality, if we're going to get fancy and linguistically on it, but basically it's how we express obligation, necessity, or permission, that has shifted to a less rigid kind of word. I've have to, I've gotta, which goes along with the shift in our culture that suggests we don't want external pressure to force someone to do something. Instead, internal volition is more important. And that idea that you could force someone, which seems to be included in the sense of must, if someone must do something, it's as if an external force is making them do it. But if you have to do it, it's your internal volition. And that seems to go along with this idea of free will and individual rights that has become very prominent in our culture in the last century.
Another example you cite of like a sort of a societal norm changing the way we use language is the idea of, and this is something that I know, I imagine will set a lot of our listeners on edge, is when somebody says, thank you. How do you respond to that? How do you respond if I were to say, thank you for being on the show today?
Oh, yes. This will generate quite a few angry emails and calls. I often respond, you're welcome and no problem. And it really sort of depends on who I'm talking to. But I know that one bothers people. And that's another fascinating shift that really has a generational divide to it. So there was a really fascinating study on a college campus where a professor had his students go and ask people for the time. And then when they said thank you, they had to keep track of what answers they got back in response to having asked for the time. And what they found were younger speakers almost always said no worries or no problem. Older speakers said things like you're welcome, or interestingly enough, nothing at all. The older speakers tended to not answer at all in that context. But this shift seems to go alongside these shifts in politeness norms, where we've moved from what's called positive politeness, where you make people feel valued and liked and admired, to something called negative politeness, which is where you don't want to impose on people and you recognize their right to have free will and be free of imposition. So when you say it's no problem, what you're saying is, yes, don't worry, you didn't impose upon me. So you're responding to negative politeness. When you say you're welcome, you're making them feel liked and admired. So you're responding to positive politeness. And we've seen a shift again over the last about a century from a positive politeness model in our culture to a negative politeness model, which seems to be driving that shift from you're welcome to no problem or no worries.
I can remember getting a compliment once. I should be thankful for that. But I got a compliment once from an editor who said, and I said, thank you. And he said, you're welcome. And it just felt so weird. And I'm in my 40s. I don't think of myself as that young, linguistically speaking, anymore. And yet it definitely struck me the wrong way. But that's totally that's totally subjective, right? I mean, different people hear that in different ways.
It really depends on what you value and how you've learned that is sort of intended. I think a lot of young people hear "you're welcome" as kind of snarky, and kind of like somehow you deserve that. You know, it's this sort of pretentious way of answering. A lot of young people feel that way about it, so that's why they have shifted to "no worries and no problems." So what we see is really it's about perspective, and different generations, different types of speakers have different perspectives on how they should read different elements of our speech.
Yeah, interesting. All right, let me take a moment to remind listeners we're speaking with Valerie Friedland, who is the author of Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English, also a professor of linguistics at the University of Nevada, Reno. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. And let's go now to line four. Steve is calling from Chicago. Steve, thanks for calling in.
Oh, yeah, you bet. Enjoying the show quite a bit. Was hoping that your guest could either clarify or add her comments to a couple of issues my wife and I always argue over. One is the difference, or if there's a difference, between the pronunciation of either homage or homage. I've heard it both ways. If irregardless is actually a word. And then finally, what I've heard a lot about, especially on TV, is as opposed to saying "it's so much fun," people say "it's so fun," and it drives my wife absolutely bonkers. So I'll hang up, and if your guest wants to comment, that'll be great. Enjoying the show quite a bit. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call, Steve. Appreciate it. All right, I don't know if you want to start with an homage to homages, or how you want to take that.
Yes, well, pronunciation is something that a lot of people like to struggle over, and it really depends on the word, but basically, there is no one pronunciation. For most of these words where we have debates like data or data, homage versus homage, those are words that have developed two different pronunciations, and generally both are accepted. A lot of times there's one that's more historically related. Sometimes it's related to dialect differences. So for example, the aunt versus the aunt pronunciation, that's related to differences in source dialects, British dialects. So in some areas of Britain, you had this shift in the 19th century, 18th century to an ah pronunciation for an at vowel. And some people took that and ran with it, and other people didn't. So a lot of these relate to early dialectal differences or impacts of new forms that come in from other languages. But, you know, with homage versus homage, I don't think there's a right or a wrong. I think it really depends on what you've grown up saying. Now, dictionaries are often sources for preferred pronunciation, and I don't know which one the dictionary has in. I say homage, but I'm sure that some dictionaries that are more contemporary probably have both pronunciations, but sometimes they go for the historically accurate one, meaning the one that we can trace back the longest. But again, I think what's key here is to understand that language has always evolved, and many of the things we pronounce certain ways today were considered wrong in another period of time. A perfect example of that is the WH sound at the beginning of words like white or whip or wine. Historically, that is white, whip, and wine. And we don't do that anymore. And in fact, Noah Webster wrote how lazy, careless, and vulgar it was to drop those H's. So again, I think we need to relax a little bit about pronunciation. Irregardless, that is
I'm
one
thinking
I hear
of
a
the
about.
Family Guy. I'm thinking of the Family
oh,
Guy,
yeah?
Cool Whip. As
oh, yes, yes, yes. I used to play that clip in my class over and over again. We got a lot of laughs that way. But that's exactly right. He's actually more accurate if you want to go historically. But I doubt many people today would say it that way. And they would think you were pretentious if you did. So we get these social meanings a lot of times associated with these different pronunciations, even though language naturally evolves and pronunciation does as well. Irregardless, is that a word? I get asked that a lot. Well, if you use it, it's a word. If it's in a dictionary, it might be a more codified word, but that doesn't make it any more a word than the fact that people are using it as a word. Whether it's a widely accepted...
All words are made up, right?
Some, I mean, right. If I just say blah, 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 yeah. And nobody understands me. That's not a word, because it's not, we haven't gotten a consensus of meaning. And that's what words are. They're these forms, sound symbols that we've agreed upon as a collective community that they have a meaning. Now, a lot of people don't like you regardless, but they do know what you mean when you use it. And many people do use it. So there is a consensus of meaning on that one. So if that's the definition of a word, then we'd have to say it is. If the definition of word is it in the dictionary? Well, I think there are actually some dictionaries it is in now, but that's a different criteria. So, you know, as again, it's a moving target. But irregardless is simply a word that is a regularly formed morphologically, meaning that we added extra suffixes and prefixes to it to add emphasis to this idea that we're saying it's, you know, regardless. I want to be even more forceful, so it's irregardless. And this type of thing happens in language. It's a blend. It's a morphological blend. And it's using natural morphology. Whether it's approved morphology from a societal perspective is a different question. But is it a well-formed word from a morphological question, from a morphological perspective? Absolutely. It uses regular English morphological processing.
So if I want to add to that, I can say super regardless or something like that.
Exactly.
I can try and coin a new one. Okay.
The key is, though, if we just willy-nilly start creating words, then no one else knows what we mean. And so that doesn't make those words. Just because we can say it doesn't make it a word. What makes it a word is that other people understand it, that we've established some norm of meaning around it. And irregardless, like it or not, people do know what that means and they just disprefer it. But yeah. if the words you just said, which I can't quite remember, but super
regardless. Yes.
Yes. So that one is a little bit iffy, but I say, let's start a movement. I'm good with that. Let's try it.
All
but
right, well,
we have to establish a consensus of meaning before we could really consider that a word, if that
makes
sense.
It's super irregardless. So super irregardless of this conversation, we need to take a break. We must take a break on the 21st show. More to come with Valerie Friedland, who's the author of Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English, 800-222-9455, if you want to join our conversation. We're going to talk about so, we're going to talk about and we're going to talk about some other tics that might bother you. 800-222-9455. Stay with us. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're talking with the linguist, University of Nevada, Reno professor and author, Valerie Friedland. Her latest book is Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. That's 800-222-9455. We got a call from Paul in Peoria. He didn't have time to stay on the line, but he has some frustrations about things he hears on public radio. One of those is people who start answers with, so, blah, 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 blah. And that is something I certainly hear a lot. We also hear a lot of ums and uhs in radio. When I pre-record an interview, I tend to edit those out, or at least I used to edit a lot of those out. I still do some. I leave a lot more in now, though. But there is one public official in our state of Illinois. I will not name them. But this person used so many uhs that I cut a 12-minute interview segment down to 9 minutes. It was really almost unlistenable the way it was before. Talk about these placeholder words like so and ah. Are they all doing the same thing in speech?
No, they're actually quite different. So you talked about so at the beginning of sentences, which is a discourse marker. And that is a class of words in English. And they join things such as therefore, here, well, okay, you know, like. All of those are discourse markers that serve to tie conversation together. So they're sort of cohesive in that way. They tell us how to take what we're about to say in reference to what was just said or something that was previous to the discourse. They also do a lot of inviting of speaker and listener inferences. They provide a connection. So they do a lot of the social work of conversation. And what we find is when we look at speech samples where we compare the same identical speakers with discourse markers compared to those without. And we ask for listener perceptions. What we find is when people do not use any discourse markers, they're less naturalistic and more robotic, and they tend to be dispreferred. So they're serving a purpose. Sometimes we find people overusing them, and that's when they seem to irk us, or using the same ones that have become popular, like so. The other thing you talked about was and those are what linguists called fill pauses. And those come up for a variety of reasons, but very different than discourse markers. And those are a little more of automatic cognitive flags. And they don't tend to pattern the same places as discourse markers, with the exception that has in the last 20 or 30 years started to function at the beginning of sentences as a bit of a discourse marker to signal intentional polite hesitation or intentional speech planning. So it has a little bit of a function of a discourse marker now, but they're not quite the same thing when you take them as in their entirety.
You know, I've heard, I'm so self-conscious today. I've heard you listen to interviews with, say, former President Barack Obama, and the man uses a lot of uhs in his conversation. I have also heard that the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was known to pause so long, and apparently without those sort of vocal pauses, that her staff took to counting Mississippis before they would jump in for fear of interrupting her, because she was just known to be very deliberate in her speech. Is there a generational element to the use of these phrases, or is it something else going on?
Well, there's a lot going on. Some of it's generational, some of it's gender, some of it's shifts in what we are trying to do in speech. And I think a lot of times the people that we associate with these features, particularly young speakers and women, are somewhat socially disfavored in a lot of contexts anyway, especially professional ones. And this serves to make us look upon these features that are associated with those speakers less favorably. But there have been some studies that show things like so and like and tend to be used by speakers that are more conscientious, because they attend more to the organizational aspects and the signposting aspects of conversation. And so if people are listening and they are less interested in those aspects, it could easily be that they find them annoying. But it also seems to be that certain speakers have habits or tendencies. So we have heavy ummers and light ummers. And Obama was a heavy ummer, or actually he liked And so sometimes it's just speaker preferences that people tend to lean on certain ones of these markers. And I think what's important here, they serve a really important function for communicating listenership and communicating intention. And I think your example about Ruth Bader Ginsburg is perfect, because if you don't use any kind of cue, linguistic cue, that you're going to continue, which an or a signal that you're just taking a pause but planning to continue, people may just misinterpret you as being done and jump in on your turn. So seem to work as listener communicative signals that a speaker is just pausing and not done with their thought. And in fact, what's really interesting is seems to signal a short delay is forthcoming. Seems to signal a longer delay is forthcoming. So they're actually quite useful in this informational capacity.
For those of us who are not beloved pop culture icons and Supreme Court justices, at least, yes.
Exactly.
let's go back to the phones. Marcia is calling from Peoria on line two. Marcia, thank you for calling in.
Good morning.
So what, I understand you have a verbal pet peeve that you want to share.
I find this cringeworthy, and I'm probably going to make a fool of myself.
No bad questions.
I really appreciate this subject. It's a kind of a interesting and fun subject. My cringe is, and I hear this with interviewers, with journalists, with speech makers, if a question is asked, many times they will start their answer with, "I mean." Now I say, if you're not understood, then you can use the words, "I mean." But to start a comment or an answer with the words, "I mean," I find just ridiculous and completely wrong.
Wow.
Comments.
Thank you so much for that, Marcia. I really appreciate it. And I'm just going to add to what Marcia had to say there. I find myself in a texting group I'm in with some friends. I use "I mean" to begin comments or responses quite a bit. So, Valerie Friedland, what's going on there?
I mean, sorry, I couldn't resist that. It's really funny because I was on a podcast a couple months ago and the host asked me that same question. He hates "I mean," and then he started the next comment with "I mean." So it's one of those things that it's, we can't resist it even if it bothers us. Well, that's one of those cases of a discourse marker. "I mean" is a discourse marker that has become more prevalent and popular as of late. And because it's become more common in our speech in that context that was just discussed, I think it bothers people. "I mean" is a connector. So what it typically does is telling, it's sort of forward looking on what the speaker is about to say, suggesting that there is a connection that they see that needs clarification in a way that they think they need to signal at the beginning of the sentence. So again, it is a signaling marker, and it does try to project on my future answer. So what I'm about to say, I want you to take in a certain way and have it relate to what you just asked me in a particular perspective. The problem is some of us misperceive that as just sort of fluff and unnecessary, and it starts to irk us. But it has become popular, and things don't pop into our speech because they have no purpose. It's usually because we felt there was a subtle clarification in terms of how people should take what we're about to say that was necessary in that context. Now, of course, in writing, when you look at tweets and things, so I don't know about your group that you're having on text, but snarky, "I mean," has also become something that we see. And that's where we often see it in written form on Twitter or something like that, where things start with "I mean," and then say something kind of confrontational or something a little bit snarky. That's not typically how we use it in general conversation, but there are a couple different ways. And I think that snarky "I mean" might have bled into the interpretation of the conversational "I mean," and sort of set us against it. Again, it's just preferences there. Same thing as the backstory "so," which you asked about before, which generally occurs when you ask me a question and I am going to give you an answer, but I first need to divert into some sort of backstory. So I start with "so," which says, okay, I'm giving you a signal here that I'm about to give you a little extraneous information because I think it's relevant to what I'm going to follow with. So all of these have information that they contribute. It's just not the kind of information we often like.
Yeah, interesting. Guideposting, we call it in radio signals. I'm going to try and bring back "whereas" instead of "I mean" here.
I love it. Let's do it.
Whereas, let's go to line 4, where Scott is calling from Rockford. Scott, talk about the term "guy."
Yeah, hi. It gets my goat when people use the term "guy" to mean all of us. And I mean, I was a teacher, and my students would do that, and I would reverse it and say, "Well, you girls," and they get upset. And I'm like, well, if you can say "you guys," you should be able to say "you girls," or just drop it. So that's what gets my goat.
All right, Scott, thanks for calling in. What do you think about that?
Well, I have to say, I actually agree with him because "guys" is a gendered term. And it's one of those cases where we often will use the male generic to cover women, but we can't seem to use the female generic to cover men. So it is very lopsided. And that has come up because we don't really have a good way to refer to plural second person. So by second person, I mean the second person pronoun of "you." We only have a singular singular form that's also used for a plural form. What's really interesting about the history of the pronoun "you" is actually originally it was only a plural pronoun and it was only used in the objective case. But now, of course, we use it for subjects as well. So that's a great example of something's gone under a radical shift. But
I think you're underselling y'all here.
I know. Well, I'm coming up to that. So this is why we have phrases like "yous," "yins," "y'all," my personal favorite, "y'all," that have come up in language to try to meet that void in our language. The other thing is "hey guys" that has come up. I'm not really sure why that took on such sort of a popular bent around the country. It seems very prevalent. The word "guy" is actually a name that was from the leader of the Gunpowder Rebellion. And when you called someone a guy in several centuries ago, it was considered an insult because you would burn "guy" in effigy for his leadership of this Gunpowder Rebellion. So it's a weird term to have come into this generic use. I think it's because we now use "guy" to refer to any person that's male. And somehow the maleness of that became genericized, just like generic "he." And it's just been a term that seems to have fallen into widespread use to talk about second person plural. But I agree that we should try to limit our use of that term because it really is inherently gendered.
All right, only a couple minutes left in our conversation. Brief personal story. Not long ago, I found myself actually thinking of something good as sick. I'm much too old to describe things as sick, but it's like, I don't know, when people say they're learning a foreign language, then they can start to think in the language. It actually occurred to me in my head that way. I'm still not going to use it out loud because I feel ridiculous about it, but how can we get more comfortable for people who do have these things that, you know, as I said earlier, set our teeth on edge?
Well, first of all, now we all know your secret. So you might as well just start using it publicly. You know, I think the trick is to think about language as this, in this evolutionary way, rather than at this one cultural moment, what bugs us and what doesn't. And remember that so many things we say and that we think are perfectly fine today, even 100 years ago, were considered bad. So you don't walk around saying, I shall do this. You say, I will do this. 100 years ago, that wouldn't have been very good. Your parents would have definitely smacked you down for that one. And even progressive forms of verbs were not widely accepted until the 19th century. So all of these things are cultural moments that make us dislike things. And a lot of times it's who's doing them, because leaders of change tend to be in social groups that are disfavored. And until they become more mainstream, we can not separate them from the users. So young speakers, female speakers, ethnic subcultures, things like that. But if we think of it as a pair of shoes, they hurt at first, but if you wear them around enough, they start to feel pretty darn good.
All right. Well, whereas this has been a very fun conversation, therefore be it resolved, Valerie Friedland, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st show.
Absolutely. Later, dude. I think that's all I can say to that.
All right. The book is Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. You can find it everywhere fine books are sold. And that is all the time we have for today on the 21st show. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about the history, another sort of legacy story, looking at the history of a racist school mascot in Pekin, Illinois. If you're from there, you probably know what we're talking about. We explored the topic in a conversation we taped a little while ago. We'll be airing that for the first time. It's new to you tomorrow on the 21st show. Our program is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Owen Henderson and Anaya Jones. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Visit our website, 21stshow.org, and you can find all the ways to get in touch with us. Let us know what you thought about what we've been talking about. Our email address is there. You can leave us a voicemail anytime, day or night. Also, links to our various social media pages. It's all on our website, 21stshow.org. You can also get our show as a podcast on Apple or Spotify. Anywhere you get your podcasts, just search for The 21st Show. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. Later, dudes.